Inheritance. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the American Legion, presents a story out of that great composite of visions, struggles, and victories of the American past, our inheritance. Yes, we Americans are heirs to a vast fortune, a fortune compounded of many things. Of mountain men blazing trails through a forest wilderness. A tattered army shivering through the winter at Valley Forge. And the voice of a great bell proclaiming liberty. It's Lewis and Clark charting a route to the great Northwest. And a brave band fighting hopeless odds at the Alamo. Let us now go back to a significant period in America's history, one which we all share in our inheritance. It was during the first part of the 19th century that the industrial centers of Ohio and Pennsylvania were using up all the available iron ore in rapidly increasing quantities. By 1850, with the never very extensive iron ore beds of the eastern United States nearly played out, our country was falling back to fourth and then fifth place among the iron-producing nations of the world. It was around that time that the Fairbanks Company of St. Johnsbury, Vermont, manufacturers of industrial weighing scales, sent a young engineer to the pioneer outposts in northernmost Michigan to investigate new markets for their product. The young engineer's name was Charles T. Harvey. While stopping for a few days in Sault Ste. Marie, he came down with typhoid. The year was 1852. Chuck Harvey was only 23 years old, but so full of energy and the will to live that it didn't take long for him to be up and around, walking in the fresh, cold air, gazing over the vast expanse of Lake Superior, and talking to the rugged settlers of Sault Ste. Marie. It was then that he first heard them talk of iron.
Yes, Chuck, me boy, it's a crying shame. Here we're sitting on enough iron to supply the whole world and have plenty to spare, while the boys down east are crying for more.
It doesn't make sense, John. If they need the ore so badly down there in Pittsburgh, why don't they build a railroad and come up here and get it?
Yeah, railroad, you say, just like was child's play. But with the nearest station, Detroit, over 500 miles away, and the cost of shipping by rail so high, iron would come more costly than gold.
Yeah, you're right, John, I know. But with the supply here and the demand there, there must be a cheap way to bring the two of them together.
Well, maybe there is, Chuck, but so far nobody's found it.
What about the lakes, John?
Yes, what about the lakes? How about riding away as women? I'll show you something.
With pleasure, John. Where to?
To a place the likes of which I bet you've never seen. It's a beautiful place where all Mother Nature has built an impassable barrier. You see that, Chuck? Back there to the west is Lake Superior, its banks stretching far over 500 miles and buried beneath the surrounding lands the richest deposits of iron ore in the whole world.
But how can you be sure?
No, experimental excavations have already been made. I tell you, whenever you sink a spade or a drill, you find ore of the richest kind.
And there, to the south?
Oh, yes, to the south, it's Lake Michigan. All the way down to Chicago and to the east, there's Lake Huron and Lake Erie, a perfect waterway right into the smelting ovens of Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Well, then, all you and I have got to do, John, is to dig a ditch to connect Lake Superior with Lake Huron, and you can load your ore right onto a steamship and bring it straight to where they need it.
Sure, Chuck, sure. Except right here in front of our noses is what you might call the fly in the ointment. 1 mile of solid rock keeping the two lakes apart.
Well, that's what I say. A couple of tons of dynamite, there you are.
Yeah, hold it, me boy. Not so fast. What you don't seem to know is that Lake Superior is there 602 feet above sea level, and, well, the others are 581.
Yeah, 21 feet difference.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that means a canal with locks and all the trimmings.
Yeah, you're the engineer, Chuck, and you know what it takes to build. But me, I've been living here for many years, and I'm telling you, with 5 months out of the year, every speck of water froze and stiff, and the thermometer never above zero, even at noon. You ain't going to be able to build any fancy locks around here.
Night after night, young Chuck Harvey listened to his friend John Whiting, listened to stories about the rich ore deposits on the ranges, the names of which became indelibly impressed in his mind. Marquette, Menominee, Vermilion. Listened to stories of the frustration wrought from the knowledge that once mined, the ore could not be moved. Soon young Harvey was seen, a lonely figure, surveying the mile of rock between the lakes, then burning the midnight oil at a drafting table, solving the seemingly insurmountable engineering problems one by one. And when his plans were ready, he went back east to Vermont to talk to the most powerful men he knew, his employers.
Mr. Fairbanks, I assure you that I've studied the project. It's both possible and absolutely necessary.
Mr. Harvey, I would be the last man to say that such an undertaking is impossible. I've lived long enough to realize that every time someone says something is impossible, some young fool like yourself comes along who doesn't know that it can't be done, so he goes ahead and does it. Mr. Harvey, can you give me one good reason why we, back here in Vermont, should risk large sums of money on a canal 2,000 miles west in the wilderness, which could not possibly be of profit to us?
Mr. Fairbanks, allow me to ask you one simple question.
Go right ahead.
What material is the most essential in the manufacture of the products which you sell?
Why, iron, of course.
Then, if because of plentiful supply, the cost of iron were to come down, it would be to your advantage.
It would?
Well, then, there's your reason, Mr. Fairbanks.
This was the kind of reasoning Erastus Fairbanks and his business-wise Yankee partners could understand. And with their influence to back him, young Chuck Harvey, still not yet 24 years of age, heard his cherished plan argued before the Congress of the United States.
Yeah, the senior senator from Kentucky, Henry Clay.
Gentlemen, the question before the House concerns some sort of a canal to connect two lakes way up north. The War Department has already refused permission to have the canal cut through the federal lands at Fort Brady, believing the undertaking impractical. And I, for my part, feel, gentlemen, that this is a project beyond the remotest settlement of the United States, if not the moon. And I therefore urge you to uphold the negative ruling of the War Department.
But less than a month after this fateful day, old Henry Clay died. Erastus Fairbanks and his friends influenced Congress to reverse its decision. On June 1st, 1853, Chuck Harvey, now nearly 24, arrived at the site of the projected canal with a shipload of supplies and some 400 fierce and rugged men.
We'll start digging here and now. Hand me that pick.
With untiring energy, Harvey threw himself into the gigantic task before him. Fairbanks and his partners, wishing to prevent Harvey's youthful enthusiasm from involving them in a long-drawn-out undertaking with ever-increasing costs, had made it clear that if the work did not progress with satisfactory rapidity, they might order him to abandon the undertaking after 6 months. On top of this, Harvey, eager to ensure their support, had rashly promised to finish the canal in a year, and now he was determined to live up to his word. So, when the first of his workers would come out in the early morning to take a look at the often cloudy sky, they could expect to find the youthful boss busy with instruments and charts, moving purposefully along the slowly lengthening path of the excavations. All day, he would be with his men, shouting encouragement, lending a helping hand, and driving them to ever-increasing effort. But even he could not delay the oncoming winter, and rumors began to circulate about the hardships which were in store for all. And the men started to slow up.
We've got to put on more men, Mr. Albers. We're falling behind.
It is not the men so much, Herr Harvey. It's a rock. Seems like it's getting harder every foot of the way. It takes two men, sometimes three, to operate these drills by hand. And then often the bits will break off before we're deep enough to put in the dynamite.
Well, I've been noticing that our supply of steel bits for the drills is dwindling. Be sure the men are as careful as possible.
If only we could get those steam drills they use back east, it would save much time.
No, I've tried to get some for months. But I'm afraid with the winter here and no ships able to cross the lake, there's little chance that they'll get here.
Better not let the men know, Herr Harvey. They're grumbling already about having to do all the work by hand. And at night, they don't sleep well. The tents are cold and damp and...
Oh, there I find you, Chuck. You better come with me for a spell.
Well, carry on, Mr. Albers. I'll do the best I can for the men. I only hope they'll do their best for me.
Chuck, me boy, we're in trouble.
What now, John?
The men are leaving.
What are you talking about?
Well, it's been going on for some time, and you've been working so hard yourself, I hadn't want to bother you with it. But I'm afraid it's getting so we can't go on much longer.
Well, stop beating around the bush, man.
The fact is that at last count, there were less than 250 left. The others simply disappeared.
Then I was right.
Oh? Did you know?
I have eyes, John. I can see that men are missing. I just didn't want to believe that they would walk out on me.
Oh, it's not sure they're walking out on Chuck. It's old man Winter. They can't take it. I've been hearing of some 50 more who want to quit.
50? Well, that's impossible.
Now listen to me, boy. Why don't you tell those friends of yours back east to shut down for the winter?
Shut down? Are you mad?
Just for the winter, sure, that's all.
I know those men back there in their heated houses. As long as they see work, there's enthusiasm. But once we stop, John, I tell you, they'll never let us start again.
Well, Chuck, I don't know how you're going to stop the men from leaving.
I'll burn every pair of skis and snowshoes and every sled in the camp, that's how.
Yeah, you'll only delay them, Chuck. You won't stop them. Any angry men make bad workers.
Well, I'll offer them more money.
Money? More money? Maybe you can fool them for a little while, but how long? The funds are nearly all gone, and there hasn't been any word from the East in months as it is.
Yes, there has.
Oh, there has. Well, you didn't tell me.
Messenger came up from Saginaw today with a telegram that arrived in Detroit a week ago.
And?
I have to go to Vermont.
Vermont? You? But, Chuck, don't you know that if you leave here, you might as well forget the whole thing?
What do you mean?
You know darn well it's only because you yourself are out there with the men in the wind and snow, working as hard as three of them put together, that any of them are not left at all. Did you know that there's a legend around here that you haven't slept a wink since the day you arrived here last June?
Well, still I have to go. You see, some of old man Fairbanks' friends have already been getting wind of our troubles here, and they're refusing to send the money.
You mark my words, you leave here, and work will have stopped within a week.
Then you go.
I?
Yes, you.
But what would I say to those fancy friends of yours? I won't know how to talk to them. No, I've lived around these woods all my life, and I'm going to stay right here.
That's just why you should go. You've lived here, and you know that what we're doing is important.
I know that, but I don't know none of them fancy words that they'd like to hear.
You've seen the ore in the ground, and you know that the job can be done.
Sure.
And that it must be done. And, John.
Yes?
When you get back east, stop at the harbors in Easton and New York and meet the ships with the immigrants. We need men. Many men. Hire all you can get.
And so John T. Whiting, Harvey's closest friend, put on his snowshoes and went on foot across 200 miles of frozen wastes to Saginaw, then by horse-drawn sled to Detroit and the nearest railroad. It was over 2 months before word reached Harvey and his stalwart men that John Whiting had been successful and was on his way back. But still the cold continued, and Harvey had to improvise ways to keep his men from suffering frostbite or worse.
You over there. Yes, you. What's your name?
Bouvard, monsieur. Liam Bouvard.
French?
Yes, monsieur.
I bet you wish you were back in France where the winter is short and fun for the kids.
No, monsieur. I came to this country because it is my wish to be an American. If I can help to build America, I am proud to do so.
You're a good man, Leon. Now, there's something I want you to take care of.
Yes, monsieur?
At each of the places where the men dump their wheelbarrows and then return for another load, I want you to station one man. And as each man comes up, I want you and your men to rub his face with snow.
With snow, monsieur?
Yes, with snow. It'll keep the blood moving. It'll make them warm and prevent frostbite.
I understand, Monsieur Harvey.
Oh, and Leon.
Yes, monsieur?
When you see Albers, send him to me, please.
Oui, Monsieur Harvey.
I understand you want to see me, Herr Harvey.
Yes, yes, Albers. I want you to take five or six men and go and find firewood.
But, Herr Harvey, we are short-handed now. If I take five or six men off the job...
If they freeze to death, they won't be any good at all. So do as I told you.
Yes, sir.
Build several large fires and make sure that they're burning as long as there are men on the job. Tell the men to take short breaks every half hour or so and stand by the fire to thaw out.
Mm-hmm.
seen the boss, Al?
Mr. Harvey? Sure.
You know, I went out this morning early because I wasn't feeling good. What do you think?
What?
Well, there he stands in the moonlight on top of a snowdrift, sighting his level.
Scares me sometimes. He never sleeps.
Yeah. So, when he sees me, he calls me over, and he asks me about my family in the country. The old country, you know. So, well, he's nice to talk to, Al. Real nice.
Wonder how old he is. Some say he's real young, but he sure don't look too young.
He's just a boy.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, only 24. You know, I heard him say that before, but I wouldn't believe it. So I asked him.
Maybe it's his beard and that hair. He's getting all gray.
Well, a job like this can give you gray hair. Sure as anything.
And he's a lonely guy. He's always by himself working. Yeah. Now with the old man Whiting in the east.
Yeah, well, he's coming back.
Boss tell you that?
Yeah. He's bringing money and new help.
You know, Sam, funny, I never missed not getting paid these last weeks.
Yeah.
No place to spend the money around here anyhow.
Yeah, well, you know, when the job is done, I'll have a nice nest egg to start in business with.
Think it'll ever be finished?
Sure will. And if it takes 10 years, and the boss has got to dig the rest of his way with his bare hands and all alone, it'll be finished.
Yes, the Sioux Canal would be finished, all right, and Chuck Harvey wouldn't have to dig it with his bare hands. His friend John Whiting came back, and the news he brought was good.
Well, Chuck, I brought a bottle of whiskey, and I brought an occasion to celebrate.
I knew you'd do it, John.
Well, it wasn't easy, me boy. When I first got there, they looked at me like I'd forgotten to wipe me boots, you know, before going into the parlor. And all they kept saying was, no.
How'd you change their minds? Tell me.
Well, it wasn't exactly me what changed their minds. When I saw they wasn't going to budge, I hopped me a train to Pittsburgh, and I get to see some of the big industrial fellows.
You did?
That I did. I tell them that I can get them iron cheap and as much as they want for the next 100 years. And you should have seen their eyes light up.
I can imagine.
And then when I get them all sold on that iron, I tell them they got to do me a favor and tell all Erastus Fairbanks, you know, back in Vermont, that he should put up some more money.
Now that did the trick, huh?
I tell you, they not only told him, they even offered to put some money in themselves. Oh, sure, we got nothing to worry about at all. They'll pay up all right.
And you brought men. You know, John, with luck, we'll finish before the next winter starts.
The top of the evening to you, Chuck.
To you, John, and to the summer months ahead.
But their troubles weren't over yet. True, with new men, money at their disposal, and the winter turning into spring and summer, the work progressed at a vastly increased pace. Ships brought iron plate up Lake Huron. From there, on horse-drawn wagons, Harvey transported the tons of metal and equipment necessary to build the sluice gates for the locks. The ring of the rivets was heard for miles around, but then came another fall, and again, as if to protect nature's stubborn barrier, disaster struck and man's progress nearly halted.
What is it, Doctor? 7 dead in 3 days. What can it be?
Cholera.
Cholera?
There can no longer be any doubt.
Men. Now, I picked you men because you've been with me from the very beginning. You know by now that, well, aside from the completion of our task here, your welfare is the closest thing to my heart. Men, a terrible disease has come into our midst, and it must be stopped. There are nearly 1,500 men quartered here now. If word about the sickness should get around, it might mean panic and probably disaster for all of us. Now, this is what I ask you to do. Tomorrow morning, and every morning thereafter, until the epidemic has been checked, as soon as the men have gone to work, you go around the barracks and tents, take those who have died into the woods, and bury them quietly. I don't have to tell you, men, that this is not to be talked about to anyone. Now, are you with me?
Yes. Some 200 men died, but when the disease was checked, panic, which might have been fatal to many more, had been avoided, and not a day of work was lost. The winter of 1854 rolled around, and still there were months of work ahead. When the freezing temperatures made working conditions more and more inhuman, nature again dramatically protested man's interference.
Watch out! Get away! Run, man! Hurry! Please, go away!
Months of work. All gone to waste.
What? What did it, Chuck? What happened? First, I thought it was an earthquake.
No, no. It was the cold. Water had been seeping in through the cracks in the rock, and when it froze, it simply broke everything like dynamite.
What now?
How are we fixed for cement?
Cement? None. But, Chuck, I think I know where there is some.
Well, then get it. I'll go down in the morning and have them start cut wood for the casings. We'll be ready to pour cement in 3 days.
And with the energy typical of the untiring Harvey, no time was lost. Early the next morning, special crews were busy writing the steel plates, while others were cutting wood and fitting the casings for the huge cement blocks, which were to replace the natural rock as beds for the gates.
Up! Four! Another 6 inches! Oh, hold it! Now, swing to the left. Slow, boy, take it slow. Four!
Watch it. Stand clear.
There she goes. Back a foot. Slow. There. And now I'll let her down. Slow, slow. More. More. Hold it. Okay.
Chuck me, boy. I'm proud of you. You've done it.
Yes, John. I just came from the East Gate. Another month with a bit of luck, and we'll be ready to open the gates.
Ah, you've made history, Chuck. Here, put her there in that chair. It's been a tough 2 years, but it's been fun, too.
Yes, another month of work, and then on April 19th, the beautiful spring day in 1855, Chuck Harvey personally turned the wheel that opened the sluice gates on the Lake Superior side. On that day, the cold waters of the Gitche-Gumee for the first time flowed into Lake Huron by the way of the Sioux Canal, Harvey's Canal. And it was just 3 months later that Harvey, John Whiting, and some of the old-timers stood on the top of the East Gate looking out into the fog. The early morning light of June 18th began to cut through the slowly lifting mist, while the nearby lighthouse kept repeating its warning.
You think, Chuck, this really would be the day?
We'll soon know, John.
There.
Can you hear her, John?
I can. And the fog. The fog is lifting. There. Look over there.
It's the Illinois. She's there.
Ahoy there. I'm Jack Wilson, skipper of the Illinois.
Ahoy, Captain.
I have greetings from the Illinois.
The steamer Illinois, under Captain Jack Wilson, passed slowly through Harvey's Canal toward Lake Superior. And it wasn't long, August 19th to be exact, that the brig Columbia, with Judson Wells at the helm, brought the first 100 tons of black iron ore from the Marquette Range through the canal on its way to the smelting ovens of the Industrial East. The blacksmith at Sault Ste. Marie fired a cannon and thus officially greeted the beginning of a new era of American supremacy in production of iron and steel, a supremacy made possible to a great extent by the vision, courage, and stubborn determination of a young engineer called Charles T. Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
You have been listening to Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. At the recent American Legion convention in Washington, D.C., Mr. Seaborn P. Collins, Department of New Mexico, was elected National Commander of the Legion. We are privileged to hear from him this evening, Mr. Seaborn P. Collins.
The membership of the American Legion represents a vast cross-section of American life. Farmers, laborers, and statesmen are to be found among our ranks of 3 million. In fact, representatives from every profession, every religious belief and national or racial derivation. All Legionnaires, however, are veterans, men or women who have served their country in the armed forces during war. The experience of the battlefield teaches two very profound lessons: love of peace and a realistic appreciation of the meaning of national defense. The American Legion, as a veteran organization, has, since its founding, urged armed strength and national preparedness as the most potent deterrents of war, the best guarantees of peace. The Legion was instrumental in securing the enactment of the National Defense Act in 1920. It advocates universal military training as the only fair method of sharing the responsibilities of citizenship and a necessary national security safeguard. The Legion was instrumental in the establishment by law of a separate Air Force Academy. The creation of a federal civil defense administration had the Legion's insistent support. The unification of the armed forces was strongly advocated by the American Legion. Patriotic national security endeavors at Legion posts include blood donor activities, organization of rescue teams, civil defense programs, and many others. The American Legion is dedicated to securing our inheritance of freedom and through the years has faithfully sought for peace through strength and preparedness.
Thank you, Mr. Seaborn Collins. Next week, Inheritance will take you on another journey through the pages of history to a time when Americans, dreaming of the future, forged that which we possess today. Today's story, 1 Mile of Rock, was written by Paul Garrison and featured Les Tremain as Charles T. Harvey. Included in the cast in order of their appearance were Dick Ryan, Ralph Moody, Ted Bliss, Robert Boone, Frank Gerstle, Jack Carroll, and Hal Gerard. This program was directed by Art Jacobson. The original music was composed and conducted by Robert Armbruster. Inheritance is produced for the National Broadcasting Company and the American Legion by Albert McCleary. This is John Lang speaking. This is the NBC Radio Network.